Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody's got the fever. This is something we all know. Fever isn't such a new thing. Fever started long ago. Never know how much I love you. You never know how much I care. When you put your arms around me, I get a feeling that's too hard to bear. You give me.
Hello, and welcome to Lenny Godfrey Straight No Chaser. Thank you for tuning in. This is our 87th episode and the last one for the 2022 season. And the next time I'll be broadcasting to you, it'll be January 11th, 2023. So I have to, in advance, tell you all to have a fabulous holiday season. Just be careful. Don't gain too much weight. Don't lose too much weight. Just try to stay the same and enjoy yourself. Now, getting that out of the way, let's remind everyone where you are. You're on blogtalkradio.com/ S as in Sam, F as in Fred, T as in Tom, H as in Harry, and the number 2. And if you want to call in, and those of you who are listening on different devices, you can dial in at 516-453-6063. And you can also use that number or Blog Talk to look at past episodes. There are 87 of them. Well, 76 are public, and then there are about 10 or 11 that are private. There are rehearsals and things. So you have the last year and a half at your fingertips of enjoying it. So if you missed me during the holidays, please go on and listen to that. I just don't want to interfere into your holiday season and cause you to have to stop anything to listen to me. We will enjoy each other in January. So what do we have on the docket today? Well, last week we talked to Ludovica Villahauser, and she was one of the presidents, there are two presidents, co-presidents of the League of Professional Theater Women. This evening for my finale, we are going to talk to the other president of the League of Theater, Professional Theater Women, and that is Katrine Helb. And I'm telling you, this international doll, I have to call her that because We will really explore her life. It's an extraordinary life. She is a director, an award-winning director, really, and dramaturg of opera and theater. And that is what's really so interesting about Katrine, because to tell you the truth, my background is training in opera, but it very seldom do you find anyone in the theater that has something that's similar that you can talk about. Also, she's worked in the United States and Europe. Being the co-president of the League of Professional Theater Women, she is also a member of the Playwrights Directors Union of the Actors Studio, TRU, the Directors Guild, and SDC. So along with that, she is and has founded an organization called Mini Tracks, Inc. And we are going to really ask her about that because it's a very interesting premise that goes along with it, because it says, for every complex problem, there is an answer that is clear, simple, and wrong. So, you know I have to ask her more about those kind of things. But in a nutshell, her life is one of constant international travel. She is U.S. born, but we'll get to that and how all of that fits into her life. And Without any further ado, I want to introduce you to my co-president, my friend. I think the consummate professional, I really have to say to you, she is. Katrine, say hello to the audience, please.
Well, hello, everyone. Thank you, Lenny, for this amazing introduction. I would like to meet that person that you just spoke about.
Oh, I meet her all the time, at least once a week.
That is true. That is true. But
no,
we sound so much better in another person's mouth, let me tell you.
Yes, it's true. It's true. But, you know, there are so many things that I want to find out about you that I don't learn about when we work together in the league. And one of the first things, though, is that I did when we were having a conversation, I did ask you where you were born. And you said Kansas.
Oh,
yeah. Yes.
Hello?
Hello. Can you hear me?
Oh, yes. You just, this was the second time that you dropped out for a bit, which is scary.
Yes, that's scary. Okay. I was trying to start our arc of your life and telling the audience where were you born and how did that really figure into all of your international travels later on in life. So why don't you start at the beginning and talk to me about it?
Well, okay. The beginning, my parents, my mother is from Kansas, or was from Kansas, and my father is from Liechtenstein, which is a tiny country. Technically, these countries are called microstates. So there are small countries like Switzerland and Austria, but then they're microstates. And
mm-hmm.
they're often historical holdovers. So Liechtenstein is one of those. It's like wedged between Switzerland and Austria, and it has 38,000 inhabitants. And my father went to university in Paris. He went to the École des Sciences Po Politique, and my mother got one of the first Fulbrights in 1949 to go to Paris for a year.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how they met. Yeah. And they already were married for 15 years before they had their first and only child.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother, on the one hand, she wanted to be close to her mother, but my parents were pretty savvy. They wanted me to have dual citizenship. So they wanted me to have the Liechtenstein passport, which at the time, Liechtenstein is a very, very traditional country. So at the time, it was the father's lineage that gave you the passport. This has changed, thankfully.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in America, if you're born in the States, but also especially my mother was American, you could also claim the passport. So I've been very fortunate to have two citizenships.
Mm-hmm.
But I grew up, my parents already were living in Liechtenstein at the time. So my childhood and high school and then university and then the first years of my professional life were all in the German-speaking part of Europe.
Well, let me ask you, what did your mother, when she went to Paris, what was she studying?
Well, she studied political science at Kansas University, which
mm-hmm.
is why they said, okay, with your Fulbright, you're going to study political science. Also at that school for political science that my father attended. Well, that was not so entirely successful because she soon realized that even her crash course in French for 3 months did not equip her to follow university courses in political science.
Mm.
However, she spent that year in learning French, and also she fell in with a group of people with friends, amongst them my dad, with whom she then got together, but a circle of friends of 7-8 people who remained friends for the rest of their lives.
Oh my gosh, how wonderful.
Yeah,
oh,
it was
yeah.
really, it's quite wonderful, yes.
And what did your, what was so, your father studying? What was he studying?
Also, that school is for political science. So he got a political science degree in Paris. And then because at the time, to have any career, you kind of needed a PhD. and he was extremely pragmatic. And so he got himself an economics PhD from the University of Innsbruck in Austria because it was easy.
Ah.
And his thesis was on labor laws of French labor laws, which, of course, nobody in Austria in 1950 knew anything about. So, and he had all the French textbooks. And so he wrote that thesis, and his professor, he told me that once, he said his professor said, fine, you'll pass, but a little less copying would have been fine, too.
I see. I see.
Yeah.
So now yeah. With both of them being interested in political science and all of this, how did the art come into your life? When was it introduced? They had 15 years without you, you said, and now you arrive and your education then is mostly in Europe. How did the arts come into your life?
That's an interesting question, because even though my father's professional life had nothing to do with the arts, and my mother, she worked for the radio before she got too immersed in my father's work. But they were both very interested in the arts. My mother was a cellist. She played the cello. My father dabbled a little in piano. But my mother was actually a very enthusiastic cellist when she was a college student. I never knew her playing the cello, which is so interesting. You know, I never knew that side of her, really. But we listened to classical music at home all the time. They would go to concerts. They would go to the theater. And I remember my father would do guessing games with me. Like, he'd put on a record of a symphony or something, and he would say, so, who's this from? And okay. I had to guess. So that was a game.
Yeah, that was it was a very interesting game because of that game. What did it pique your interest in music? How did your interest in the opera start? Did you go to operas early on in life?
No, I mean, interest in music is actually a fun fact. It was just understood that I would learn an instrument. I don't think as a 6-year-old I was even asked. The only question I was asked, which one? But opera came later. That came a lot later. So I played the piano for a long time, enjoyed it, was lazy, enjoyed it. And then when I was 16, I wanted to stop playing the piano for various reasons. And my mother said, no, you have to do something else. Then you have to pick up another instrument. And I said, well, I would like to sing. And I was 15, and she took me to a teacher, and that teacher said, well, 14, 15, wait another year for the voice to be more fully formed, just because adolescence, you know, when also for girls, as you know, Linny, being a singer yourself, it's sort of it's a transitional phase. So once that was cleared, I was 16, I started taking singing lessons, classical singing lessons, and that piqued my interest in opera. Just really from the doing side and then being confronted with arias that I then learned to sing, of course, not that well, but still. So that sort of opened my mind to that very particular art form. And I just got more interested in it. And then when I went I wanted to become an actress. So, I don't even know how that happened. I just remember in my diary when I was 10, I wrote, I want to be an actress. So it's not as if my parents really put that in my head. It just was there. I just, I was always on the arts side. And they didn't do anything to stop it. You know, they nurtured the direction that I wanted to go in. If I had had a strong science bent, they would have encouraged that. Opera, in the end, took them a bit of doing, because when I then finally said, and that was years later, when I said, oh, I not only opera, I want to be an opera director. I want to dedicate my, you know, opera. Mm-hmm. They kind of took a deep breath and said, opera, okay, fine. Mm-hmm. Okay, we should maybe go to some.
Well, I know how the voice, especially when you study classically, it's a specific genre. And then depending upon the teacher, of course, you know, your concentration is really on that genre of music, even though there are, I mean, when I was studying, I started studying younger than you did. I was about 9 or 10. So I actually went through the change of voice with my teacher, you know. But I found that even though all the wonderful music was around me, when you are studying that genre, it does do something to you. It's very specific, and it does take your attention. It doesn't mean that you don't appreciate anything else. Of course you do. You enjoy everything else. But it is a challenge for you, I believe, as a singer, as a young singer. I remember all of that, really being able to, and of course being American, trying to conquer all the different languages and how they come off, some harder than others, some softer than others, and how the placement is and all of that. But even more than the technical part of it, it's the interest that I think is so very key when I think about being a young person being introduced to the world of the classics, because in America, the popular music was, you know, far more available to you. All you had to do is turn on the radio, and there it was. You had to do, it's just like when you decide to eat healthier, the foods that are fast foods that contain a lot of things that are not as great for you are easily available. But those things that are healthier for you, you have to work a little harder to get to it. I found that that was the way that it was with music. Did you find that, or did you enjoy any other kind of music, or was this the only kind of music you enjoyed?
Oh, no. I mean, I was a normal teenager, and I was enamored with all the bad pop of the 80s and 90s. I mean, come on. That's my world. ABBA, yeah. Forever, and then Pink Floyd, King Crimson, yeah. And then Nirvana. I mean, no, absolutely. Yeah. I listened to some jazz, but I have to also say I have no siblings, but my father's younger brother, he had two sons, and one is a year older, one is a year younger, and because we were so close in age, we often went on vacation together, and both also became musicians.
Mm.
My younger cousin is a drummer,
mm-hmm.
and a composer, and he is now really my claim to fame. He's quite a very well-known percussionist, Gregor Hilde.
Mm-hmm.
And his older brother, Alex, is a flutist and saxophone player, and they started as jazz musicians.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a completely different direction from mm-hmm. mine. So, of course, I listened to some of what they were listening to. And it's really interesting that our generation, another cousin of mine, she became a pianist. So our mm-hmm. generation was very artsy-fartsy, and the parent generation, no. I mean, interested in the arts, but not professionally involved. So it's really interesting how that shift happened. But no, I was, of course, very interested, you know, in all other kinds of music, still am. But I really found much more here in the States. I mean, I've been now in New York for 20 years. But here in the States, when I travel across country, I try to look for a radio station. What they call classic is classic rock. You can hardly find a classical music station. It's impossible.
They have disappeared. A lot of the stations of music have disappeared off of the radio stations, where it's just mainly one genre that is highlighted all the time. And that's sad, because when I was younger, you could find it. There were stations dedicated to classical music. There is one when I first moved to where I live now in Pennsylvania, out of Philadelphia, there I used to listen to at night a classical station, but it only came on for about 4 hours, and then it was usurped by something else. I don't know if it does anywhere, because our connection, our radio connection here, I live in a mountain, so it's not, I can't get that anymore. But what's interesting is that, no, in the United States, it's not treated the way it was when I was younger. It really isn't.
Right, yeah.
Now,
Yes.
No, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. No. You proceed. Tell me.
I'm just trying to build. It's like Lego blocks. I'm building the art. So I see, as I see that happening, and I see you saying you wanted to be an actress, and then was there something that happened that turned you into around another corner that made directing and dramaturg those things very interesting to you? Was it something in school? Was it a play in school? What do you remember?
It was actually a pivotal experience. You have to realize I grew up in a village with 6,000 inhabitants. I mean, we had a theater there, which was a guesting house, that had surprisingly good, it was like a touring house. So, but the artistic director really got amazing stuff into there. So I had an incredible theatrical education. But I did not know there existed a job like director. That was not a thing. I knew actor, I knew singer. And then I was, during my, because I majored, when I started going to university, I majored in philosophy and minored in musicology and then English and American literature. So in musicology, I was offered first an internship at the City Theater, and then I was asked if I wanted to be assistant director to an opera production that another student did, sort of an indie opera production. I said, sure, why not?
Mm-hmm.
And in the middle of those rehearsals, the director, which normally a director hardly ever does, there's this one scene where a goddess comes in, sings an aria to the two protagonists, is angry with them, and leaves. And he said, I have no idea what to do with that. Why don't you try it? I said, okay. Okay. So I took the piano score home and was in bed and looked through it. And I suddenly realized, oh, my God, I have ideas. And I wrote down notes. I could do this, and this is what it's about. And then I was really in luck that the singer with whom I rehearsed, I mean, it was one aria for that she addresses to Paris and Helen, but I didn't need them to be there at the rehearsal, for the first rehearsal. And thankfully, she was so pleasant and open to my ideas. And I was suddenly like a fish in water. And I thought, oh, this is what I'm best at. Because the problem was, I had this creative oomph which wanted me to be an actress, and I played in all the high school plays, and I... the singer, so I had this creative one. At the same time, I also have a strong sort of intellectual bent. I really enjoyed poring over texts and my philosophy studies. So there was a sort of an intellectual sort of cerebral side, and those two sides were always at war with each other.
Mm-hmm. I could, uh-huh.
But in the rehearsal, suddenly, boom, it was like two hands clapped.
Yes. Yeah, well, you then found a way for both of them to be married.
Then I thought, yes, this is it. But I was halfway through my master's program, and at the time there was in the Swiss system there was no such thing as a bachelor, so I couldn't just quit. And I said, okay, fine, I'm going to finish. But that's when I started seeking internships and assistantships to gain experience. I finally knew what I wanted to be, namely an opera director. And I told my parents, which then drew this big breath from them and they started going to opera to familiarize themselves a little more, because yes, they were lovers of classical music, and dutifully they would go to the opera once a year, but then yes. they were not in love with it.
No, they were patrons. It's nice, but you never think of it as an avocation. No.
No, but also, you know, you have to be in love with it, too. My mother then actually did fall in love with it.
Absolutely.
My mother then did actually in the following years, she actually fell in love with it. And then once I was out, she would then go with my dad, and she would make him go to the opera with her because she really wanted to see and hear. Mm-hmm. But they were just nice parents and said, okay, if that's what our daughter wants to do, we better familiarize ourselves.
I understand. Yeah. Well, you know, you didn't get a lot of resistance. So what you got was the support of it. So,
yeah.
And that is not rare, but it's so wonderful to hear about, because in the case of many people who decide that they want to come into the arts, the tradition in the family might be in education. They want you to go into some kind of corporate structure, something more reliable. And so when your parents recognize that you have a passion for it, that's the most important thing. Now, passion doesn't pay all the bills all the time, but passion makes you happy. So once you're happy, then you find a way to keep your happiness going. Now, you know, that's kind of how, that's how I relate to it. I mean, the path that I took was, of course, I always thought that I was going to teach school. And then once I got into college and realized that I wanted to really be a professional, well-rounded in the business, and do it full-time and not just do it on the weekends, not just sing on the weekends. It was a different kind of commitment because I had already been working in a corporate structure and had thought, well, you know, until I get a teaching job, I'll work for this company, which happened to be at the time the largest company in the world. So when I decided that I didn't want to do that, my father almost went into cardiac arrest. But then he said, well, if you're good at it, you'll see how it is, you know, if you're good at it. And finally, from the Broadway stage, he just kind of nodded his head in my opening night. And he said, okay,
right.
This is what you should do. Okay, this is what you should do.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. I mean, I was also very goal-oriented. Once I knew what I wanted, I tried to get some experience, and then I was assistant director at two houses because at the time there were just not as many directing tracks, you know, to learn. Mm-hmm. You learned on the job. You became an assistant director and you learned by assisting.
Yes.
You know, learned from the good and bad and the ugly, you know, and if you were lucky, and that's when you got opportunities to direct something small, and if you did well, something larger, and then, you know. So I got some really nice inroads, and then I made a career-wise fairly detrimental decision, namely to not quit my assistant directing job, but take a grant year to be in New York for a year.
Mm-hmm.
So the state of Liechtenstein has this program that it's called Work Year for artists who are already working. So it's not an educational thing, to go to a place of their choosing, as long as they can argue that it behooves their artistic development, and they will subsidize you for a year.
Mm.
And I have fallen in love with New York in the late 80s, 1988-89. And I just said one, it was already sort of a bucket list item. It was like, I want to live in New York one day. I don't know how long, but I want to live here. And so I applied for this work year and was granted that, and I moved to New York in the worst possible time. Well, because that's when the program started, which was exactly a year after 9/11.
Oh, my gosh. Oh.
Yep.
Oh.
September 5th, 20...
Let me backtrack just a little bit. So what was your connection with New York? Had you been there before? Had you, did you know, was it seeing it? What made you want to live in New York?
Well, I had been to New York a number of times with my parents. Whenever we would visited family in Kansas, we would often pass through New York for a day or two because my parents had friends in New York. But as a child, I didn't really catch fire that much. I liked it, but it was also daunting. But then when I was 20 or 90, I don't remember, but no, I was at university. I had a boyfriend who lived in New York for a year.
Mm-hmm.
So I was in school in Switzerland, and whenever I had a semester vacation, I would be in New York. So I would spend two summers, 88 and 89, being in New York, and also having sort of, he got me small jobs. I mean, one was just doing the files for a choreographer, and the second year I was, so I still love, and that. I now still run into people who were on that same thing. I was a production assistant for a film called Basket Case 2, The House of Freaks.
Hmm. Okay.
Yeah, which was a sequel to the amazing cult hit Basket Case 1. Which actually, really surprising, it was a cult hit. There's this whole genre of cheap... horror sci-fi, and Basket Case by Frank Henenlotter was made like for no money and then was a cult hit, and so he made a lot of money, and then 8 years later, a little derailed by I think one or two drug addictions, he then finally made the sequel.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually made two films. The Basket Case 2 was shot back to back to another classic called Frankenhooker. Yes, it was amazing. So I watched Lamps. I learned what KY jelly is.
Mm.
I made a number of friends. Well, because that's what they have these enormous monster masks, and they were covered in KY jelly to make them shine.
Wow.
And of course, the makeup department was full of double entendres and bad jokes, which flew all over my head.
Okay. I can imagine.
Yeah, so that was where my love, and that was pre-Giuliani, you know, that was 88, 89.
Yes.
And I remember I was entrusted to bring the film roles. I mean, I was driven, but because I lived close to Times Square, I lived in Hell's Kitchen at a time where cabs wouldn't go there.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. I remember dropping off the film roll at 4 a.m. and I didn't have to cross Times Square. I mean, God, they would never let me do that. But the mayhem of Times Square at 4 a.m. and the prostitutes literally running for cover into the arms of the cops away from their clients or pimps or whatever stuff was breaking loose. It was, you know, it was a different world.
And what's it?
And I'm not that romantic about it because I do enjoy being able to go into Central Park after dark. But I that's when I really, really fell in love with New York, and it was just I want to be here. I want to live here at some point. I didn't expect this year is my 20th year.
Oh, how wonderful. Well, being born and raised there, I'm always fascinated about what, you know, how it appeals to other people who are not born there. I mean, because I was born there, it was just where I was born and I loved it and learned how to get around, and that's it. You know, you're a native New Yorker. That's what you do. But you, and your family's, you know, your family is there, your friends are there, your school is there. So It has a different feel, so it's always interesting to hear how it appeals to other people. I am interested, though, in how your international life started to take place, because you're in New York now. You've decided you want to move into New York. You're doing that, but then you kept your contacts in Europe, so that you work back and forth now, don't you?
Yes. It sort of fluctuated. I mean, the first year was really, I really thought I would go back eventually. And there was a revival of Verdi's Falstaff already the year after. So I would work, I would, you know, be here and then I would fly over there. It also, and there were years where I worked more in, or primarily in New York or in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
But there was always, I never lost the connection to Europe, also because, I mean, I had my family there, my parents.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I would go over there. I mean, the first couple of years I had, my partner was in Frankfurt and I had worked at the Frankfurt Opera, so I did also something at the English Theater in Frankfurt. So I always aimed to keep connections going to the best of my abilities, but had to realize that if you're not there physically, you can't build as much. So I focused more on building New York contacts and then realized that New York afforded me the opportunity to expand into straight theater, which in Germany I didn't have that opportunity. Opera directors are not considered real directors.
Okay. All right. So
yeah.
How did it evolve here? How did you get into, what was your first theatrical direction here then in the United States?
The first theatrical, for straight theater, I first did an opera. I assisted an opera for Arizona Opera. I assisted a Zalome and then directed a Zalome in Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
Funny that I did a lot of Zalomes. But then I took, just to get sort of into the door theater, I took the 3-day CTI workshop here in the city, and I met a woman who then connected me to a playwright who was looking for a director for her play for the Midtown International Theater Festival back in the day. And that was really, you know, and she interviewed me, and for her, oh, you direct opera, so you must really be really good with crowds. So that's really impressive. So it didn't deter her, which I thought was fabulous. Mm-hmm. And that was really sort of my first foray into straight theater. And then, you know, you build. You just work more, and I had to learn, because I came knowing where singers live, and I just had to learn, you know, in which way are actors, singers different from singers, and how to communicate successfully. And you know, after about 10 years, I felt, okay, I'm now on a par in my comfort level and knowing where actors sit and where singers sit.
Mm-hmm. Now you do both. You direct in both Europe and the United States. And how, well, before I ask you that question, in 5 years, where do you want to be in your life as far as your career is concerned? We'll get to the personal part later, but in your career, where
I would love,
change?
Look, let's assume that I stick to what I'm doing, then I would love to have artistically, creatively interesting, challenging, but growth projects for opera and or theater, both here and in Europe. I do love working in both worlds. And it doesn't necessarily have to be Germany. I mean, I had projects that I took to the Edinburgh Festival Fringe. I rehearsed out of London. What I would really love is to have projects, productions, directing opportunities on both continents that are artistically rewarding.
Mm-hmm. So how does Mini Tracks Inc. fit into all of it? Tell me a little bit more about it. Tell me about the creating of that.
Yes, this is Mini Tracks. I founded in 2009, basically to put a shield around my personal self. And whenever I decide to self-produce or produce in collaboration or in cooperation. So that's not me, Katrin Hilbe, producing something, but that there's an entity. And it's not an LLC. It's a very simple S-Corp. I don't aspire it to be a season. It's really when I want to produce a play that I also want to direct. Mm-hmm. And the quote that you mentioned at the beginning is an H.L. Mencken quote. I didn't make it up. It's an H.L. Mencken quote. For every complex problem, there's a answer that is clear, simple, and wrong. And that suggests to me that most important topics, most complex issues, they can't be boiled down to a black and white soundbite. They are multifaceted. They're complicated. Mm-hmm. And so I'm interested in theater that lets that complicated quality stand. I'm not interested in course. Every Many Tracks project has a political aspect because, you know, even the personal is political. It's not partisan political. It's not, I'm going to tell you why you should be against this. I'm going to tell you why you should be for this. Mm-hmm. But rather taking an issue and exploring it theatrically. Mm-hmm. And it started, what did we start it with? I think one of the first ones was The Man in the Newspaper Hat, which is a two-hander written by a poet, Hayley Heaton, about Ezra Pound and Elizabeth Bishop, two poets, and Ezra Pound, who was remanded to a mental asylum for his anti-Semitic and pro-fascistic leanings. Mm-hmm. And it really is the topic, is it possible to bypass somebody's abhorrent views and actions in the sense of propaganda? I mean, he broadcast from Radio Italy into the American sector. Can you bypass that and still honor and connect with the enormous artist that Ezra Pound was? And Elizabeth Bishop, at the time, poet laureate of the Library of Congress, in the play tries to do that.
Hmm.
She fails. It's not, she doesn't succeed. And the interesting thing about this play was it's not a biographical play. It's not a historical play. It's based on a poem by Elizabeth Bishop. And the play, in a way, reconstructs based on the poem how the meetings between Ezra Pound and Elizabeth Bishop could have gone. So it's a dramatical fictionalization.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so it really leaves the audience came out really discussing. So how do you feel about this? Is Ezra Pound now, is he just, can we read him? Should we read him? Where do we stand?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I want to do. I want audiences' minds to be opened by theater, not to let in ideas, to let in the imagination, to sort of an openness.
Yeah, not to dictate.
I don't want them to be filled with answers.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know? And so every project that Many Tracks has done And the last one was in January 2019. That's, you know, then the pandemic happened.
Mm-hmm.
But every project had sort of a complex issue that it explored at heart with very theatrical means. You know, I'm not into lecturing from the stage.
Well, now, believe it or not, as I told you, this goes fast. So we only have about 10 more minutes. So in that 10 minutes, there are a couple of things that I'd like to know. Your life has been, it's been involved in the league for a number of years. And probably this year, when you step down from as co-president next year.
Yes.
What would a perfect day be like in your life once you step down? What would that look like?
A perfect day. Oh, that can be many, many things. And I hope I have perfect days until then, even before I step down.
You know what I'm saying. There are always things that we want to do while we're occupied with our allegiance to commitments that we have. So
yes.
As those commitments wane and we have more time to think about, you know, when you are committed to something, you say, oh, when I have more time, I'm going to do this. When I, you know, when I get my money right, I'm going to do this. When I do all. So
mm-hmm.
That you have the time, once you have the freedoms that are not allowed you right now, because I know how hard you work. I know how both of you work. You work incredibly hard 24/7. You know, there's not a day that you all are not doing something for the league. But when that does begin to ebb, what do you want your life to be like? Where do you want to be able to, what freedoms do you think you'll be able to achieve that you can't now?
That's a twofold answer, because on the one hand, there's the personal level where I would just love to be able to, for instance, you know, travel. I don't travel. I commute. I commute between New York and Liechtenstein.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be really lovely, you know, to say without anxiety breathing down my back, to say, let's go for a couple of weeks or 3 weeks and go away. Or just idleness, the possibility to have time to dream. Time to dream, being bored, because actually there's a power in not knowing and in I do not, this is one of the things that I really suffer right now, and I'm actually taking a beautiful workshop with David Diamond right now about mid-career theater artists or to explore, but I don't have time right now, is to just have the energy and the oomph and sort of the dream space that a vision, artistic vision, creative vision for new projects that I could also produce or take in hand that and foster, you know, see sort of rainbow colors forming and patterns and pursuing that. And for that, I need mental space that I just don't have right now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I totally understand.
And that's not in so much into a perfect day. It's more into allowing, sort of removing myself from admin and also, in a way, also league necessity, because the future of the league is very close to my heart. I'm very attached to the league. I mean, I joined the league in 2010, and one of the things is because I was not you know, I didn't go to school in the U.S. So I didn't have all these built-in theatrical connections. And the League was a place that I could join, that took me in. And it had an international committee that I just threw mm-hmm. myself on. And I think mm-hmm. I mentioned to you before, it was Ludovica who brought me into the League.
No, I did not know that. I did not know that.
Oh, yes. Yes. No, Ludovica and I go back.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even remember when we first met. It was sort of lost in the mist of time at this point.
And when did
yeah,
you all...
so that is really sort of a place where there's peers, professional peers, theater peers, a network to just be, have people to talk to and to connect with and, you know, especially when you come from outside. I found that extremely helpful. And then also the International Committee at the time was very active. And I made some wonderful friendships. But it is true. I mean, it's a volunteer organization, and you only really can do that and connect if you make yourself available to give time and energy.
Absolutely. You really must invest in it. In order to
yeah.
get to I say it all the time to people, but you get out of it what you put into it. And I have
yeah.
got, you know, in these last couple of years, I've only been there a couple of years, so much in relationships and conversations and you know, connections, and not connections in the way that it's an advance, a career advancement, but connections of understanding that people think like you think or don't think like you think, and
mm-hmm.
you still have the ability to understand it. You don't have to agree with it, but to be able to understand
mm-hmm.
it, and that makes you grow even more. That's
yeah.
one of the wonderful parts of it. I am going to start to start ending this now, so you can take a breath and get ready for our video part of it. Because,
okay.
Because now people will be able to see who they've been listening to for an hour, almost an hour here.
Okay.
And we'll continue. I do have a couple of more questions, not very long, because you really have been quite wonderful. It, you know, just mm-hmm. creates the whole arc of how you came to being the Katrine that I know. And you don't, when you work with someone, you see them on a daily basis, but you never see the foundation of
mm-hmm.
where they come from. So this has been truly, you know, both of these conversations with both you and Ludovica, it's been truly so revealing, because it does explain so much of how you work and a lot of the focus of how you work, both of you being very dedicated to the organization, but very different
mm-hmm.
in how you both approach it and your background. So I'm going to let you take a breath while I say a few things to my audience, and then mm-hmm. I will see you on the webinar, and the audience should know that that link is on Facebook if you want to join us. If not, we will be just talking for a few minutes there. But I want to thank you, Katrine, because I'm telling you, this is, I mean, it's been revealing, but I still have a couple of more. Now, you don't take too long of a breath.
Nope.
You got to talk a little
bit. I won't.
But thank you, because...
Thank you.
You know, the insight to what your journey has been, is going to be, because that's what I really want to talk about, you know, what it has been, and thinking about where, you know, when we talk about in 5 years what you want to do, but how the business is determining that also. What about the business? And keep that in thought. What about the business where we are now and how that's going to influence? So I thank you for giving us all of that time, all of that information. And I will see you on the webinar. And ladies and gentlemen, those of you who have always been so considerate to come and tune in, every Wednesday at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I want to thank you for that. I want to make a special reach out to Joe Fenton. Joe Fenton is a woman who has really made me aware of the fact that I've not done enough to reach out to my complete audience. I have been deficient in trying to communicate to those people who maybe have difficulty communicating the ways that we take for granted. And Joe has introduced me to the system of creating captions when I can on some of my videos, and you may see that now, and that's a very important thing for me, and to be able to become aware of all the people who I have not satisfied. If you could just let me know what it is that I need to do, because I have an ignorance about that. So in my break, don't forget me. Just think about things that I can do, and please contact me on Facebook and let me know those things. And so I can, when we reconvene in January, that I will be, I think, a person who's much more aware of all of those things and all of the needs that people have. I have a great desire to be well-rounded in that area. So thank you, Joe Fenton. Thank you, all of you, really, for always encouraging me to continue, and from all over the world, and those of you who listen after it's been broadcast because it's at 3 o'clock in the morning your time, thank you for tuning in. Thank you for also going back and listening to some of the most wonderful of the interviews that happened in those 87 episodes. And I look forward to absolutely providing you with another season of conversations about how the arts has influenced our lives, whether we're in it, whether we are patrons of it, whether we support it, whether we're just beginning to learn about it or educating people about it in the education system. So thank you very much. And with that, I wish you the most wonderful holiday season. Safely, really make sure that everything is safely as you can. Remember, we still are in a situation where we should think about our health and try to explore and get the biggest part of life that we can, but please do it in the most healthy way. So with that, I, Lenny Godfrey, am saying to you, thank you very much for supporting Lenny Godfrey Straight No Chaser, and I'll see you on the radio January 11th, 2023. Bye-bye now. Everybody's got the fever. This is something we all know. Fever isn't such a new thing. Fever started long ago. Never know how much I love you. You never know how much I care. When you put your arms around me, I get a feeling that's too hard to bear. You give me fever. When you kiss me, fever. When you hold me tight, fever. In the morning, fever all through the night. Listen to me.